from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Carl Ingwell is working on a degree in the University of Utah's Environmental Humanities program. And when he learned recently that Rocky Mountain Power and the Utah Mining Association and a company owned by Rio Tinto, among others, had given money to the program early on, he felt betrayed. Ingwell says it doesn't make sense for an environmental education program to be taking money from extractive industries. But Bill Johnson, a professor at the U who has been thinking a lot about that relationship between universities and corporations, says by now we should have outgrown the impulse to simply see industry as the bad guy. And he says there is a way to accept donations from these companies without compromising your principles. Besides, schools may not have much of a choice because private money is having to fill in a gap of government support. So there's the dilemma that we're talking about after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Not so long ago, Carl Ingwell, who's been a student with the University of Utah's Environmental Humanities program, discovered some of the companies that had given money to get the program started were companies that, to him anyway, seemed at cross purposes to environmental protection. Companies like Kennecott Land and the Utah Mining Association. So Ingwell contacted KUER's Judy Faze, and her reporting has raised a question we're going to take on today. Should universities, like the University of Utah, accept money from companies and corporations that don't seem to share their values? This issue has come up recently at the university over the question of whether the school should stop investing in oil and gas companies, for example. So what's the compromise you make when you take money? How much influence does that money have on the school? What does a company want for the money? And why do universities need private money in the first place? Because increasingly they just do. We spoke with Carl Ingwell earlier this morning, and we started with his reaction to learning the humanities program had accepted seed money from extractive industries.
Personally, I just felt a little bit betrayed and a little bit like the work that I was doing and the studying that I was doing was being invalidated by this, because we worked for 2 years saying that these entities are bad and we're going to do the best we can to take a little bit of power away from them. And then the Environmental Humanities Program, whether they like to admit it or not, they're giving back those entities some of that power by listing them on their webpage as friends of the program. So I felt like it just kind of took my research and said, yeah, that's great research, but we're still friends with these guys.
What do you think these companies want in return from the university?
You know, when a company like Kennecott donates money to the University of Utah, and they donate money all over the University of Utah. It's not just seed money to begin the Environmental Humanities program. I mean, they helped build the brand new Natural History Museum on the Hill, and they donate money to all sorts of different programs across campus. And to me, I think that what they are trying to do is to soften their image a little bit and say, you know, make people forget about the work that they actually do over there in the Ochre Mountains. And, you know, now when you think of Kennecott, you think of this, you know, nice philanthropic entity that just donates money to all these programs, including environmental programs at the University of Utah. And it's kind of glossing over the fact of what they're actually doing in the world, which is destroying the Ochre Mountains.
How do you judge, Carl, when a company isn't worthy or shouldn't be worthy of making a donation or a contribution to the Environmental Humanities Program in particular, or in general, the university?
I think a company that is heavily based off extractive industry should not be donating to an environmental program. It's as easy as that.
One of the things you've talked about is that you think corporations are essentially trying to co-opt the environmental movement right now. I'm interested in that. What do you mean?
You know, a company like Kennecott is doing things all over the valley and letting people know how environmentally friendly they are. Well, they're not telling us how environmentally destructive they are. They're just making it look like they're these great environmental stewards. An example of this is I do a lot of work in air quality, and a couple years ago, Kennecott completely co-opted the clean air movement in the Salt Lake Valley. You might have noticed they had idle-free billboards posted all over the valley, and they're making these public statements that they are, you know, number one in cleaning up the air. Well, that completely ignores the fact that they are the largest industrial polluter in the Salt Lake Valley.
How do you react to the dilemma that's going to come up today in the program, in the conversation, about universities are trying to deal with the fact that they're getting less federal and state money. Tuition isn't necessarily cutting it either. And so they're having to find private sources to fund important programs like the Environmental Humanities Program, like scientific research. And so they're, in some ways, some of the companies that have, from your perspective anyway, the sort of dicier ethical base also have the deepest pockets. So how do you think a university should resolve that?
Of course, I'd like to say that higher education is funded by state and federal sources. And unfortunately, it's not. And that's why we see things like major extractive industries donating to universities. And you see things like higher tuition costs and students that are going into, you know, crippling student debt to be able to make their way through 4 years of higher education. And so I would like to see just none of that happen, but unfortunately that's not the reality that we live in right now. So I don't know how to answer that question, actually, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Like, I think that we shouldn't even be in that situation in the first place where we're faced with that dilemma. It's do we fold or do we take money from extractive industry?
It's Carl Ingwell. He's an environmental activist, a former student with the University of Utah's Environmental Humanities Program, joined us this morning from Monticello, Utah. We should thank Judy Faze. Her reporting brought Carl Ingwell's concerns to our attention. And we should also mention, of course, the KUAR is part of the University of Utah. So Rocky Mountain Power is a current donor to the station. We've received support from the Huntsman Corporation, Rio Tinto as well in the past. And we're also, as I said, sort of under the umbrella of the university itself. So we should probably get that disclosure out of the way. Joining us now on the program is Jeffrey McCarthy, director of the University of Utah's Environmental Humanities Program, also a professor in the university's Honors Program. And Professor, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's good to be here with you.
William Johnson also joining us, a professor of geology and geophysics here at the university and an adjunct professor of civil and environmental engineering. We should also say he's past president of the university's Academic Senate. He led discussions around whether the university should divest from fossil fuels. That'll come up a bit, I think, here today. And Professor Johnson, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Let me just begin. Jeff McCarthy, one thing that you've said, you told Judy Faze in her reporting, I wanted to begin here. You said that we need to make a kind of ethical valuation about places from which we take money. You said we can't be part of what's called greenwashing for organizations that we have these and that have ideas, you know, from companies that have ideals that are contrary to ours. So that question of how you make that evaluation, how are you thinking about that? How do you decide? How are you thinking about all of that?
Well, I think that one of the things that I think that one of the things you can do is be guided by the energy and passion of your students. I really think it's very helpful that Carl has brought this forward, and I thank him for bringing it forward. You know, it turns out we're kind of leaders in this, so this is a good conversation for us to have in environmental humanities. Yeah, you're right. There are certain donations actions an environmental program probably shouldn't take. Our students come to us, part of their ideals really are wrapped up in questions about climate change. Yeah. We have a whole generation of students for whom questions about climate change, questions about climate justice are absolutely central to how they see their education and also their lives. And for these students, you know, and for us, it's hypocritical to work with people who are climate deniers and to work with the big fossil fuel companies who have been at the center of a certain amount of this climate denial, a certain amount of this climate obfuscation. And so in the same way that if you were, say, an animal rights organization, it would be hypocritical to take money from Purdue Chicken, it would be – it's problematic for us to look for funding from fossil fuels. But I do want to make it clear that the EH program has never been has never worked at the behest of its donors. We do not cultivate gifts from industry, and we have not been influenced by gifts from industry. And the
but you took seed money from industry.
So a dozen years ago, yeah, and that's worth talking about.
Yeah.
Those gifts. So university fundraising records. So going and doing the research, we find that those gifts came through in October of 2004. And they
did you wince when you saw those names, when you learned about it? Bother you like it bothered Carl?
And let me tell you why. I'll talk about that interpretive moment actually. But first of all, those gifts came in the amount of $500 here, $2,000 there.
Yeah.
So very nice gestures, but not enough money in total to pay for a single student for a single semester. So these gifts have never shaped our freedom to pursue any ideas in the classroom, any of the research that our faculty do, any of the efforts our students make.
I get it, but do you regret? I mean, it wasn't very much, so why take it in the first place then?
Well, here's what I think is interesting about that. So
you're having to answer for somebody else's decision. I get it, but
yeah, right.
But
I'm willing to, and I'm interested in it because when I looked at those gifts, Doug, what I saw was a kind of inclusive vision on the part of the founders of the program, a sense that this was going to be a unique program that brought various perspectives together and fought hard to get us to cross the aisle between positions that have become entrenched and polarizing in American politics and in American environmentalism. And here we have a program that says, hey, let's talk to the people who seem to represent other ideas. Let's get into the room and have the hard conversations that really are going to be part of any kind of solution moving forward for environmentalism.
Bill Johnson, that's something that you're interested in, right? That sort of interplay, that a positive kind of dialogue. That's what you're looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to address what I think is a misunderstanding on the part of Carl Engwell and many people in terms of the relationship between, say, a corporate donation and tuition, because tuition isn't dictated. It isn't really directly related to donations in any way. What the donations do are to create opportunities for students primarily. They typically are directed towards scholarships and projects that create opportunities for both undergraduate and graduate students. So to link that to quote-unquote crippling tuition is really not correct. That relationship is not correct.
Okay. But to the point, though, that by giving these donations, these extractive industries, among others, are trying to clean up their reputations, try to portray themselves as philanthropists. What do you say to that?
Well, so there is truth in that. One has to be kind of vigilant about the motivations behind a donation. But then again, it's very difficult to treat a corporation as monolithic. It's hard to treat an individual as monolithic. I know people as individuals who I can trust in certain matters, and in other matters, I wouldn't go near them.
Yeah.
Right? And a corporation is going to be far more complex than an individual.
One of the things you've said to us earlier is that we should have outgrown – this is what you said. I liked this. You said we've outgrown the idea that industry is just necessarily bad for the environment and environmental regulation is just necessarily bad for the economy, that there are these two false statements here, and we need to sort of mature? Is that what you're getting at in the way we think about this?
Well, I think it's the role of the university to explore that,
yeah,
that tension, right? To create more mature perspectives among the students, among the faculty, you know, all of us, because it isn't simple. And there are opportunities for win-win situations that we should be looking for.
I want to come back to the win-win thing, because I think that could be a takeaway from the conversation. You both agree that this is good that students are bringing this. It's good that students are mad about this and that we're talking about this. I think we can agree with all of that. But then to the question of Jeffrey McCarthy, how do you judge? When does a company cross the line? When you decide, all right, this is a bridge too far for us. We shouldn't take money from this.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, Doug. I mean, that's been a question that I've been talking about with students since this story broke. And that's this question of where do our borders lie?
Yeah.
You know, what's in and what's out? And to me, it seems like a learning opportunity. I mean, not all corporations are bad. Let's get beyond simplifications. But I think what it says is that for us, that the EH faculty, the community of faculty, students, and alumni need to get together and have a conversation about where should our funding come from, what works for us. Maybe we can be actual national leaders in this conversation for environmental nonprofits. Many of our graduates go and work for environmental nonprofits, and they face precisely this question in their own funding. So I think that we can be at the center of the conversation for environmental organizations about what is going to be our relationship to this funding landscape around us.
So, I know, but you didn't really answer the question. So what's the cutoff point? When do you say, that's too much? Nope, we can't do it.
Well, I think what I'm trying to get at is that it's, to my mind, it's not my question to answer so much as it is a question that will be answered by our community.
Got it.
Our community is going to meet in 2 weeks for 3 hours on a Thursday night to get together and talk through the various possibilities of and kind of use the wisdom of those many people and many voices to say, hey, you know, these are some possibilities draw the line.
So you can't find an algorithm and say, we plug it in here. It's got to be a conversation. There's got to be give and take.
Well, there are best practices out there, right?
Sure.
I mean,
no,
there
course,
are people.
Course.
So,
yeah.
There are institutions that have said, we divest completely from fossil fuels. There are Hampshire College. There are institutions across California who have said, we divest from coal-fired power generation. Right. Back in the when I was in college, we were part of a divestment movement that had to do with South Africa.
Sure.
Like there are places that you can say we're going to do this and not that.
There were shanty towns on the campus of the University of Utah. I don't know if any of you guys were around during those days, but I remember them. So that question, yeah, is that those questions come up on campus?
And my point, though, is that I guess to answer your question, I think that what needs to happen for us to be a leading program is for us to apply our skills as critical thinkers and as sort of careful thinkers about the broad variety of factors in play to arrive at the best possible solution we can at this moment that says, you know, here's where we're going to draw the line about corporate donations. I can tell you this. You know, nobody's knocking on my door. There's not a lot of three-piece suits showing up at our doors to throw money at us,
yeah.
You know, and we have real work we want to do.
Yeah.
There are real efforts we're making in this community, and it's hard to
And you're not going out
and
seeking
money.
That money either.
We're not seeking that corporate money, but there are good corporations who match our vision and our mission that we would be potentially glad to talk to. That's the conversation our community needs to have, and I think we'll be stronger for arriving at a clear sense of just what that means and what we can do.
Professor Johnson, you were president of the Academic Senate, and in the spring, the Senate voted to divest the university from fossil fuel. They made a recommendation, put it that way. What was that debate like? What was the vote was fairly close. There was sort of 0.1, 0.2. I mean, give me a sense of how that played out, what the result has been from your perspective.
Sure. Yeah, we had a series of events, I guess, that were developed by two committees of the Senate. One focused more on the financial aspect of divestment, how it would be accomplished, what percent of our holdings are in fossil fuel-related investments. And then the other committee was more about spreading the word, about examining the issues related to climate change, and then specifically how fossil fuel divestment relates to that bigger issue. And I would say that the conversation culminating in the Senate meeting last spring, and I think it was in April, you know, there's, I think, vast majority of people on campus understand climate change and the impacts that are occurring and the need to address it, right? There's no real controversy among faculty or right. students here, right. I don't think. But where there is controversy is in how you respond to it, and specifically how you respond to corporations that produce the fossil fuels that we use.
Right.
So we brought the divestment issue to a vote because there was a resolution that was developed by one of the committees towards complete divestment from fossil fuels. And that vote on that resolution was in a perfect tie, 40 versus 40.
Wow.
And had I been a quick thinker, I would have used my power as Senate president. I had the right to cast my own vote.
Yeah. And you would have gone against it.
Yes, certainly. I made that clear.
Yep.
But it didn't feel right to do that. But what I wish I had thought at the time was to preserve that tie because that's the real message. I wish I had used my vote to table it and to say we've got a tie and there is no majority one way or the other because it's a complex issue.
Yeah.
Now, we did go on to vote on a second resolution, which was more positive. It wasn't about
sustainability.
Yeah, it was about investing in alternative energy resources and other pathways towards sustainable energy development.
Is that the win-win you were getting at earlier?
That's an example of a win-win.
Yeah.
And so that passed by a vast majority. I don't remember the numbers, but it was a clear winner, and was the real message.
Sorry. So one of the lessons you're saying from that is that let's have the discussion, and let's find those areas that we all agree on and work on that. As you know, we can put the debate aside, we can still work on that, but let's find the areas of common interest, and there seems to be some there.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. Yes.
One of the big questions that also comes up is why this is an issue anyway, because there's not as much federal and state funding going on, so you're going to have to be going to private sources. And I wanted to get a sense from you, Danny Elliott, who's going to be joining us on the program a little bit later. She mentions in her writing that elite schools don't have this problem in the same way public schools might. Which is not to say this public school is not elite. It's, you know what I mean? But public institutions have these difficult decisions to make. They have to cut programs. They may have to increase class size. They may have to whittle down faculty. How much economic pressure are you finding at the University of Utah that you're having to deal with that you might have to – where there's a vacuum you need to fill by going to some of these private sources? Just – you know what I mean? From the university's perspective.
So – it's really discipline specific.
Yeah.
Okay. So, in fact, in my discipline, I work in the environment. I'm interested in water quality issues. There really are no private sources of funding specifically for my kind of research. It comes from federal and state and local sources. And you know, that funding ebbs and flows. Yeah. It was great during the during the beginning of the recession when there was a bunch of federal money put into the system. And it's highly competitive to land those grants. We work very, very hard to land those. But in other sectors like oil and gas exploration, you're primarily dependent, in fact, you're almost solely dependent on private industry, right? And the people who need to explore for those resources need to be trained. That's what part of our program is, in training students to find those resources. And my colleagues in that discipline, you know, point out that if we're to change the practice of that industry in the future, we need to be training students in how that might work. You know, they need to have – we want to be part of that solution, not just simply divorce ourselves from that industry. Because that industry carries expertise, for instance, in ocean platform construction, which could pave the way towards wind energy harvest.
So let's say BP says, "Hey, I'll give you guys $1.5 million." What you're saying is, let's consider that money.
Well,
or our students should be talking about considering that money, because that's often where the money comes. Yes?
Yeah. Well, in that sector, that's where it comes
from.
That's
what I mean.
Right?
Yeah.
And so certainly students are going to be looking for opportunities to be able to be trained up in these technologies, to develop a career. And the goal in maintaining a relationship with these industries is to help form them into the future.
Right.
And so by just blanket saying these industries are evil, we are not going to associate with them, it's strikes me as problematic on two counts. One is you are eliminating the future possibility towards new avenues, you know, injecting university perspectives into these industries. And then second, there's a kind of an integrity issue here, personal integrity issue, in that and I think it's reflected in the Senate vote. I mean, this may be overly broad, but I would say about half the group saw the fossil fuel industry as a trap in which we're all caught. And the way to get out of it is to divest from that industry. The other half sees the fossil fuel industry as a trap in which we're all part of. We're part of that net. We utilize the resources produced, and therefore we're culpable. And until we can find alternatives, we're not going to hold together our personal integrity in pointing at that industry as the villain.
Is the go ahead, please?
Yeah, I'll jump in on that, and I like Bill's answer. I think that it points to the way that the university is a pretty big climate, and there's different weather in different parts of campus, you know, and so you know, in the humanities, our funding situation is quite different. I mean, we tend, and it's worth distinguishing between sponsored research here and I think donations or gifts, and so we tend to work in the realm of gifts, and that money goes towards scholarships or fellowships for students, and there's no kind of expectation of outcomes from that work. In a world where,
but you're not suggesting there's an outcome in an expectation of work in these other fields that we were talking about.
I think
about.
When we talk about sponsored research, and now I'm not talking about the examples that Bill gave, but if we talk about sponsored research, if Weyerhaeuser gives a certain amount of money to Oregon State University and says, hey, see how quickly these trees grow back on a given hillside, well,
they're expecting an outcome.
We're expecting a particular outcome, and there's a relationship with Weyerhaeuser there. That's a very different thing than if, Ken Garth, Cars gives some money to the Honors College.
Right.
There's no expectation that we're all going to drive around in a certain car.
Can I let Bill Johnson respond to that before you finish your point? How do you react to that idea that in some way you could potentially compromise the integrity of just the science by taking certain money if there's an expectation of an outcome?
Well, that potential certainly exists, but you have to rely on the individuals conducting the research, right? Because what should guide them, and I think it really does in the vast majority of cases, is learning something new, right? Creating new knowledge that can be transferred to other situations. That's really what drives scientists and engineers, not fulfilling the agenda of a particular entity. And so if that's what's driving it and everybody's playing, you know, honestly, what should happen is if they find something unexpected, for instance, that the trees don't grow on the hillside, you know, that becomes public knowledge, and that avenue certainly isn't a good one for, you know, clear cutting. So that's the hope.
So finish your point. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
That's okay. No, that's interesting. I think that given that less than 20% of the university's operating budget is filled by state funds now, and that number continues to go down all around the country, universities are needing to look for outside funding. What this means, though, is that conversations like we're having – in this room are more important than ever. We need to look closely at how these dealings happen. We have to have clear standards for what expectations come with donating. But I don't want to say that all donating is bad. I'm in the middle of trying to raise funds for two fellowships for students from underrepresented backgrounds. We'd like to change the complexions of environmentalism. We'd like to include people who have previously been left out of environmental conversations. This is especially important as environmentalism becomes more and more about things like environmental justice. So where does that money come from? Yeah. You know, if there's somebody listening who has an idea for where I can get $20,000 more a year, I would love to hear from them, right? These are real needs. And this is the ethical and I'll be quick about this, but this is the ethical kind of balancing act. On the one hand, it's very nice to be able to say, well, I don't want any money from Fidelity because I don't believe in the banking industry and the finance industry's excesses. On the other hand, what are the ethics of saying, we don't have money to support your fellowship anymore, right? What if you're trying to raise money for some students and your morality on the one side gets in the way of their education on the other side? Again, this is a community decision that I think happens in different ways in different pockets of campus.
William Johnson, let me give you the final word since we're essentially out of time. I guess the point, and this is something Jeffrey McCarthy has talked about too, is you've got to have the conversation. You've got to involve students in the conversation. That dialogue is the critical, one of the critical parts of this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because nobody has a fully formed opinion, I think, going into this. And both faculty and students benefit from this dialogue. Everybody comes out with a better perspective.
William Johnson, professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Utah. Jeffrey McCarthy, director of the university's environmental humanities program. Thanks, gentlemen, very much for joining us.
Thank you, Duke.
We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been working through an ethical question. Should universities accept money from companies and corporations that don't necessarily share their values? The question has come up recently at the University of Utah. We've been talking about it. Joining us now on the program is Denny Elliott, an ethicist and ethics scholar. She chairs journalism and media studies at the University of South Florida. She's written a number of books on higher education fundraising, and she's joining us from a studio in St. Petersburg, Florida. And Denny Elliott, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to begin with the question of funding itself, because you've written about that, the pressures that universities face to come up with money for their programs. I mean, it would be nice to have public money, but I guess it doesn't necessarily work that way anymore.
Right. We definitely have moved over, from a model of state-supported higher education to models that are now more tuition supported, and that puts more of a burden on students and on families than we've had before, which means that universities, public universities, are looking at private funding in a different way now than we did maybe 20 years ago.
How did we get to that point? How did the landscape change? Because this is something that you write about.
Well, you know, just economic changes over time and economic priorities. The amount of a tuition bill for a student in a state university 20 years ago or 40 years ago was a lot smaller piece of the family bill than it is today. And I think that we recognize in higher education now that we're at a tipping point of where students and families are wondering, is a college degree really worth the number of years it's going to take me to pay this back? And so we need to look at many different models of higher education than the traditional model. But that may take us a little bit away from this question of, well, you know, what money is clean enough for us?
Yeah. Let's get to that point. What do donors want? Here's a question you ask in your book, and it's an interesting sort of case study I wanted you to maybe discuss. Here's how you write it in your book. You said, should a donation be accepted from a man who has thrown Adolf Hitler birthday parties, who has a large collection of Nazi memorabilia, wants to keep a controversial mascot at the university. Should a university take his money? Now, this is a very particular case, but it raises, it seems to me anyway, a question that you're interested in. We'll talk about this case and the questions it raises.
Well, you know, we're talking about the fighting Sioux here.
Yep.
I think that we need to dissect the question of whether how we want to vet funders versus how it is that a university uses that money. And I think that those are two different questions. First of all, in terms of motivation, I don't think that we know how clean any donor is, whether we're talking about a corporation or whether we're talking about a private donor. So I think that that if a university wants to say that that a particular donor is in violation of our values, and I think I'm thinking of religious institutions in this respect, then they certainly can make that choice. But I think that the real issue is how it is that a university uses the funds that they're given and how much freedom they have to make those choices. That's where I think that the particular case that I wrote about in the book gets interesting. And what I hear the University of Utah folks talking about is, the community decision-making.
Yeah.
I think the community decision-making is important, but not at the point of do we accept this particular donation.
What do you mean? Why?
Well, I think it's too easy to be influenced at the moment by a new hockey rink or by a particular scholarship that wouldn't be otherwise available, or for an academic researcher, money to really explore something I've wanted to work on. I think that at that point of the specific donation, that it's too easy to be swayed into the decision that we really want to have happen, the outcome that we're looking for.
Right.
So I think that it's in a period of calm when we're not looking at particular money that the institution needs to make some choices needs to set some boundaries about what a donor can dictate and what he can't. One of the phrases I've used over the years is that somebody can endow a chair, but not who sits there.
Right.
I hold an endowed chair in media ethics and press policy, and that that dictates the area of some of my research, but it doesn't tell me what I need to conclude.
Are universities establishing those kinds of guidelines, or do the realities? Here's the thing. You say in the last 20 years or so, donor expectations and higher education's willingness to accommodate those expectations have drastically changed. Explain how.
Right.
Explain how.
Well, some of the earlier folks, Jeff and Bill, got into this a bit in talking about sponsored research versus donation.
Yeah.
And we can throw in venture capitalists as well. That folks with money and corporations with money, I think, are more focused now than, say, a few decades ago on the specific difference they'd like to see in the society, in the community. And so they're not hesitant to dictate what it is they're hoping that their financial resources will help bring about.
Right.
But I think that...
Is that different? Is that different? Did it not used to be that way? People would just say, here's my money, do whatever you want.
I think that the directed donations, the sponsored research, the venture capitalism side of American philanthropy has changed over time, yes.
Yeah.
But no one is forced to take a gift.
Right, of course.
I think that's a simple and important truth, that every university has the power and the responsibility to determine how a gift is used, or to turn it down if the strings are going to be problematic. And so I guess that's one way of saying that the gift should be in line with university values. But I think the important thing is that university values is seeking new knowledge, is teaching and learning. And so unless you've got a potential giver who wants to dictate a particular outcome, then I think that there usually can be a way to negotiate a gift from a legitimate giver for a legitimate reason.
I wonder, I'm interested in you because you write that we have to throw into the mix this kind of new kind of philanthropist has emerged in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, the venture philanthropists. And they combine, you say, wealth with activism. Where do they fit in this picture?
Well, I think that they're free to dictate the conditions of their gift, and the university and researchers are free to negotiate around that. Many of the medical schools now no longer will let a particular researcher take money from a pharmaceutical company to research a drug that that the pharmaceutical company has interest in. They've recognized that that's just too close of a relationship. But Big Pharm can certainly put money elsewhere in the university or elsewhere in the medical school where it can't be seen as even creating the appearance of a conflict of interest with academic freedom. So if a venture philanthropist, as you put the term together, that's a nice phrase. If the venture philanthropist has interest in research on Zika, that's fine. That money can't be used then to research breast cancer.
Yeah.
But if the philanthropist comes in or the corporation comes in with, we want you to come to a conclusion that agrees with a particular view, that's not okay for academic freedom.
Yeah.
Even if sponsored research comes in, a corporation with sponsored research comes in and says, well, we want to vet your findings before they're published, that's not okay. That interferes with academic freedom. And so I think that that's the important value in higher education, is the freedom to seek and to learn.
Yeah. So that's great in theory, but is that what's happening? Given the realities now of some institutions, take out the elite ones that have massive endowments. If you say that there's a simple truth here, that no one is forced to take that money, but if you're feeling financial pressures and some company with deep pockets offers you a big chunk of money that could really help that program and yet has an expectation that's a little dicey, that's problematic. And it doesn't seem it's that easy to just refuse that money.
Well, that's why universities these days have advancement professionals. They have people who are skilled in working with the interests of the university as well as the interests of corporate givers, for example. And I think that an important point that's been made on this program is that this isn't a good evil yes no sort of choice. It's not that there are some corporations that are evil and antithetical to the mission of higher education. You know, even if we just stay in the area of, say, of environmental sustainability, the question of whether we value the wild grasses over the wildlife that would feed on them, mm-hmm. you know, it gets to be a nuanced tension. And so what we don't want is to take in money in a way that interferes with academic freedom.
Denny Elliott is with us. She's chair of journalism and media studies at the University of South Florida, author of the book The Kindness of Strangers, also the book The Ethics of Asking. We need to take another quick break. Back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about that sometimes uneasy relationship between corporate money and universities. Denny Elliott is with us. She is chair of journalism and media studies at the University of South Florida, author of the book The Kindness of Strangers and the book The Ethics of Asking. She's been thinking a lot about these questions that have been that the University of Utah has been talking about. That's been one of the case studies we've been discussing today. I want to ask you about the divestment question. That's going on right now at the University of Utah. It's going on in other schools as well. What does this question fit for universities who are trying to decide, should we stop investing in oil and gas companies? How does that fit in the question?
I think that it's difficult to ask a university, the large complex being that it is, to provide total consistency when you are talking about donations, corporate sponsorship, investment, academic research, what's taught in the classrooms. You're never going to find a neat fit for all of that because learning is messy.
Yeah.
And seeking new knowledge is messy. And so I think that the nice thing about investment and divestment is that those are decisions that can be made along the way, both in terms of keeping an eye on what's going on now, on what's going on in the future. And that's something that is usually not open to community conversation, but I think it ought to be.
I wonder how – I was thinking about when this was several decades ago now, when the conversation was going on in college campuses around the country about whether they should divest in government – in the South African government because of apartheid. How is that different from the question of whether a university should divest from a fossil fuel company? How is that different?
I don't think it is different, and I don't think it's different from deciding where the athletic clothing and is made. And I think that university communities do have an obligation to be aware of where their investment's going, of where products are coming from. To be aware of carbon footprint. If institutions of higher education aren't looking internally and trying to be transparent about this, then we really can't expect that from anyone else in the country.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm saying is I think that these are important matters that rarely are part of the campus conversation, and I think they need to be a continual part of the campus conversation, not just, oh, I'm not comfortable with this particular donor at this particular time.
Yeah. You've written about the fact that in this current environment where universities are having to rely more on external donors, you say in your book, The Kindness of Strangers, that those in charge of raising the money, that you know, the financial side of an institution, that they're more and more willing to allow donors to assert more control. So I wanted to get you to talk a little bit more about that. And I guess the question that I wondered about is, it seems like there, and this is oversimplifying it, but it seems like there's sort of two sides to a university. There's the content side, the ones, the research, the science, the education. There's that part. And then there's the money-raising side. And I'm wondering, are you seeing the money-raising side, the development side, taking more control these days on university campuses?
I think that for too long, that division that you describe has been in place. And I think that that's a problem. You know, it's interesting to me, and I've been studying ethics for 30-some years, and that the least developed area of ethics analysis is ethics in higher education. I mean, if you take a look at bioethics or journalism ethics or ethics in government or business ethics, for that matter, those areas have flourished where ethics in higher education has a much smaller set of scholars and a much more limited set of scholarship. I think that ethics scholars and students of ethics need to look internally at the university in ways that we have been spending a lot of time and effort looking outside. And so that's a long-winded way of saying that I think that the educational side of the house needs to be studying the financial side of the house.
Right. One of the things you've written about is sort of the history of how we got to this point. We don't need to spend a lot of time with that, but one of the sort of conclusions you've come to is that, you know, what you had going on in the 20th century, for example, the GI Bill and other things, is you had this kind of what you say, this social contract that developed where education, higher education, was seen as a basic social good, and that funds, people were seeing public funds as worthy of paying for that. Now, things have changed a bit. So I'm wondering, can we go back? Can we ever go back to the idea where you get more public funding, or are we just going to have to start making these compromises because the public funding is not going to be there like it was?
Well, I think we can move forward in more public funding, and I think that you know, we've seen President Obama talking about this in terms of community college, or first 2 years of college being free at public institutions. I think that as we go forward, that higher education needs to be seen as something that's important and good for our society as a whole. And we need to fund educational resources the way that we do other resources in this country. And that means that, yeah, I think we do need more public funding for education so that we don't have students and families going into the deep debt they are, even mm-hmm. for a state school education. And we don't have the dependency on the kindness of strangers that can lead us into problems. But while we're waiting for that to happen, I think that every institution can start having the difficult dialogues, the campus conversations, where students and faculty and administrations and finance officers are involved in the discussion of what are the boundaries of money that we accept, what are the boundaries of where we buy our products, what are the boundaries of how we invest our funds.
That's Denny Elliott. She chairs the Journalism and Media Studies at the University of South Florida. Among her books is The Ethics of Asking and The Kindness of Strangers. She joined us from a studio in St. Petersburg. Denny Elliott, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Emily Anderson. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.